in Syria in early 2013, taking its declared capital, Raqqa, in March of that year. The administration refused to order airstrikes against ISIS camps in Iraq in the fall of 2013, when the Iraqis were urging us to, and when ISIS fighters were more in the open. In January 2014, they took Fallujah and Ramadi, and then Mosul in June, which seemed to shock the administration into action. Russia's and Assad's insistence to the contrary, the regime and its ally didn't concentrate their attacks on ISIS, but on other rebel militias, which by the middle of 2014 were fighting ISIS in some areas more than they were the regime. President Obama announced in September 2014 his intention to bomb ISIS sites in Syria in concert with an international coalition, and to at last begin providing arms, including anti-tank weapons, to the FSA. U.S. Special Forces deployed to northern Syria in October 2015 to advise the Kurds, Syrian Democratic Forces, and other forces fighting ISIS. By the end of last year, the coalition had launched nearly 12,000 airstrikes. As many as 2,000 special operators and Marines were in Syria, and it appears that many of them will be there for a while. I went back to northern Syria in February of last year to meet with our Syrian Kurd allies who would bear the brunt of the fighting to take Raqqa, and with some of the brave Americans helping them. It would be the last time I shared the company of soldiers in the field risking their lives for a just cause. And as ever, they were an antidote for despair. ISIS was forced out of all its occupied territory in Syria and Iraq, though thousands of ISIS fighters are still present in both countries. Last April, Assad again used sarin gas, this time in Idlib province, and Russia again used its veto to protect its client from condemnation and sanction by the UN Security Council. President Trump ordered cruise missile strikes on the Syrian airfield where the planes that delivered the sarin were based. It was a minimal attack, but better than nothing. A week before, I had condemned statements by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, who had explicitly declined to maintain what had been the official U.S. position that a settlement of the Syrian civil war had to include Assad's removal from power. Once again, U.S. policy in Syria is being presented piecemeal in press statements, I complained, without any definition of success, let alone a realistic plan to achieve it. As this book goes to the publisher, there are reports of a clash between U.S. forces in eastern Syria and Russian volunteers in which hundreds of Russians were said to have been killed. If true, it's a dangerous turn of events, but one caused entirely by Putin's reckless conduct in the world, allowed if not encouraged by the repeated failures of the U.S. and the West to act with resolve to prevent his assaults against our interests and values. In President Obama's last year in office, at his invitation, he and I spent a half hour or so alone discussing very frankly what I considered his policy failures, and he believed had been sound and necessary decisions. Much of that conversation concerned Syria. No minds were changed in the encounter, but I appreciated his candor, as I hoped he appreciated mine, and I respected the sincerity of his convictions. Yet I still believe his approach to world leadership, however thoughtful and well-intentioned, was negligent and encouraged our allies to find ways to live without us, and our adversaries to try to fill the vacuums our negligence created. And those trends continue in reaction to the thoughtless America First ideology of his successor. There are senior officials in government who are trying to mitigate those effects. But I worry that we are at a turning point, a hinge of history. And the decisions made in the last 10 years and the decisions made tomorrow might be closing the door on the era of the American-led world order. I hope not. And it certainly isn't too late to reverse that direction. But my time in that fight has concluded. I have nothing but hope left to invest in the work of others to make the future better than the past. As of today, as the Syrian war continues, More than 400,000 people have been killed, many of them civilians. More than 5 million have fled the country, and more than 6 million have been displaced internally. 100 years from now, Syria will likely be remembered as one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes of the 21st century, and an example of human savagery at its most extreme. But it will be remembered, too, for the invincibility of human decency and the longing for freedom and justice evident in the courage and selflessness of the white helmets and the soldiers fighting for their country's freedom from tyranny and terrorists. In that noblest of human conditions is the eternal promise of the Arab Spring, which was engulfed in flames and drowned in blood, but will, like all springs, come again. Chapter 6, Fighting the Good Fight, with and against Ted Kennedy. It was the summer of 1993, and a new administration was still finding its footing. I had won my first re-election to the Senate, putting to rest doubts about my long-term prospects in the Senate that had arisen during the Keating Five scandal. A few Democrats had come to the Senate floor to speak in support of the new president, Bill Clinton's budget. Several more were there to defend Clinton's Surgeon General nominee, Joycelyn Elders, whose history of controversial remarks on abortion, the sexual activity of minors, and Republicans had, unsurprisingly, generated opposition in our caucus to her nomination. Barbara Boxer was there, speaking in her usual lacerating style, as were several others, including Carol Moseley Braun, the newly arrived senator from Illinois, who had beaten popular Al the Pal Dixon in the Democratic primary in 1992, and gone on to beat my friend and Reagan administration alumnus, the late Rich Williamson, in the general. The crux of the Democrats' complaint was that Republicans were filibustering the nomination even though the debate on her nomination was only a few hours old. Republicans, feeling themselves unfairly abused, had started lining up to fight back. Don Nichols from Oklahoma was there, as was my closest Senate friend at the time, Phil Graham. The Republican whip, Trent Lott, was there too. I was just crossing the floor on my way out of the chamber. I hadn't paid any attention to the debate. I don't remember if I was even aware of the issue in contention. Nevertheless, I sensed the rising temperature in the room and the irritation of my fellow Republicans, and I'm a sucker for a fight. One of the reasons I'd become close friends with Phil was because he was quick on his feet and especially good in a really lively debate. I stopped near the door to the Republican cloakroom where my administrative assistant was standing and asked him what the fuss was about. He was starting to explain when Ted Kennedy interrupted Trent, which got my attention. I had been aware that Ted was sitting at his desk when I entered the chamber. You were always aware when Ted was on the floor. He had a booming voice and laugh that could be heard in private conversations with colleagues, often over the sound of whichever speaker was addressing the Senate at the time. He had a presence you noticed the moment he arrived, and a reputation for being a ferocious adversary in a floor fight, bombastic to be sure. But his cutting sarcasm, his mockery, is what you most feared. He was one of the most experienced members of the body, expert in its procedures and customs, and he always had one of the most talented staffs in Congress. Going up against him was never easy or lightly undertaken. As a rule, I tried to keep my distance from him. I hadn't wanted to make an enemy of him, but I also didn't want to fall under the spell of his camaraderie. He was good company, funny, and hard to resist when he was in full-out charm mode. He could get you to agree to something you didn't want to do, or at least something you sensed wasn't in your best political interests. But this, too, was part of his reputation. Whatever he promised you in exchange for your help, he delivered. He kept his word, which is the Senate's principal virtue, or was for many of the years I served there. I believe he had already spoken on the Elders nomination that day and was just reading papers at his desk. Until he interrupted Trent, he had seemed to be ignoring the debate as I had been. Senate procedure allows you to interrupt a senator who has the floor as long as the purpose of the interruption is to ask a question. In practice, the rule is used to interject criticism or an insult with a question mark punctuating the abuse, like the way contestants on the game show Jeopardy have to frame their answers in the form of a question. Mr. President, will my friend yield for a question? Can I ask my friend if he understands his position is the devil's own work and will surely destroy the republic? As soon as Kennedy started interrupting to ask his question, I stomped down to my desk, picked up the mic, and started calling for regular order, which demands that the presiding officer recognize the speaker who had the floor before the interruption. Ted kept asking questions, and I kept demanding regular order, both of us getting heated. Even after we sat down for a pause, we were both committed and itching to get back into it. Things had died down a bit when Mosley Braun sought recognition and began excoriating Republicans in personal terms. She compared Republicans to Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor of the Spanish Inquisition. Don Nichols interrupted her and asked if she understood Rule 19, which states, "No senator in debate shall directly or indirectly by any form of words impute to another senator or to other senators any conduct or motive unworthy or unbecoming a senator." This time it was Kennedy who demanded regular order. Nichols responded that he wasn't making a motion to invoke the rule, only asking Mosley Braun if she was aware of it. Kennedy just ignored him and kept yelling, "Regular order! Regular order!" I shot to my feet and demanded the same. "Regular order, Mr. President! Regular order!" Kennedy addressed me directly. "That's what we're asking. Regular order." Nodding at Nichols, "He has to ask her a question." "I did," Nichols replied. "Regular order," I insisted. "Regular order," Ted shouted back. Anyone unfamiliar with Senate procedure and the behavior of senators, which is probably all but a tiny fraction of the American population, wouldn't have had any idea what the fight was about. The debate had become a free-for-all, ungoverned by Senate rules. The presiding officer looked confused and a little scared as he struggled to regain control. He was a recent addition to the Senate's ranks, appointed to finish Al Gore's unexpired term. An unfamiliar face to most of us, he would leave the Senate not long after with the same status. That day, he looked as if he would have liked to have gone back to Tennessee right then. Mosley Braun seemed bewildered, too. Having somehow lost her right to the floor without relinquishing it, she had no idea how or if she should get it back. I guess Ted and I felt our ability to address each other directly was too encumbered by the intercessions of our colleagues and the formalities of addressing the chair. Neither of us signaled the other, but in the very same instant, we both put down our mics and charged to the well of the Senate. There, standing inches apart, we let each other have it in personal and profane terms. Reporters, seated in the gallery above us, leaned over the rail, straining to hear our unamplified exchange. A few of them caught the F-word, lending emphasis to the insults hurled back and forth. Our behavior was certainly unbecoming of senators and unworthy of the Senate, a place I have come to love. After a minute or two, we realized we were being observed from above and retired to our respective corners. We stayed engaged in the debate for the time being, giving actual statements on the nomination rather than interrupting each other. But as things became a little less lively, our enthusiasm waned correspondingly. We left the floor at the same time through the same door. Ted threw an arm across my shoulder, and we both started laughing as we complimented each other's combativeness. It wasn't our first time sparring. We had exchanged a few shots before in Armed Services Committee hearings and members' meetings. But this one was memorable for how carried away we had gotten, and even more so for the fact that I think it might have been the first time we had made each other laugh. We hadn't become fast friends or allies. We were just friendlier with each other after that, and respected each other more. It would be several more years before we started working closely together on a few issues, after I'd lost the Republican nomination to George Bush in 2000. I'd returned hoping my newly acquired national reputation would increase my influence in the Senate, as Ted had returned to the Senate in 1980 after losing the nomination to Jimmy Carter, determined to make the most of his opportunities here. I wanted to get some things done in that Congress, particularly campaign finance reform, an issue that had been central to my campaign. And Ted was willing to help where he agreed. He was also, for a time, intent on convincing me to switch parties. The Senate was evenly divided, 50-50, a fairly rare occurrence. Because Republicans had won the White House, and the Vice President can break tie votes in the Senate, we were technically in the majority. A single defection would have given control to the Democrats, so although we were friendly, Ted's interest in my political conversion wasn't exactly fraternal. His relationship with Carter, never close to begin with, was reportedly permanently icy after their 1980 contest, each party nursing resentments. Maybe Ted thought I felt similarly about my victorious opponent and saw an opening to take advantage of our disaffection. Various enticements were offered, including, at some point, the chairmanship of the Armed Services Committee. Tom Daschle, the Democratic leader, joined the discussions. I listened and was flattered, but insisted in every conversation that my differences with Democrats were more numerous than those I had with current Republican orthodoxy. After a while, they relented. In truth, there were some hard feelings after I lost, but I got over them a lot sooner than many people believed I had, and sooner than the lingering antagonism between our staffs had faded. I disagreed with President Bush on some issues, including a few big ones like his tax cuts. But I agreed with him on other things, most things really, and I liked him. He's likable and a good man. Last but not least, I was a Republican, a Reagan Republican, still am, not a Tea Party Republican, not a Breitbart Republican, not a talk radio or Fox News Republican, not an isolationist, protectionist, immigrant bashing, scapegoating, get nothing useful done Republican. Not, as I am often dismissed by self-declared real conservatives, a rhino, Republican in name only. I'm a Reagan Republican, a proponent of lower taxes, less government, free markets, free trade, defense readiness, and democratic internationalism. I also believe government should respond to our biggest problems and prepare for our biggest future challenges, be as transparent as possible and as efficient as possible. There are a lot of government responsibilities that have needed to be reformed for decades, especially one of my pet peeves, our broken government acquisition system. I believe the same can be said about the rules of contemporary politics, the way redistricting is done in most of the country, and the explosion of unlimited and dark money in campaigns, an invitation to corruption made possible by the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case, a mistake made by five justices who never ran for any office and were more naive than a cloistered nun about the corrupting effect of unlimited money in politics. I believe in the separation of powers, a press free to report without fear or favor, and free to infuriate politicians, including me, as they do. Lastly, I believed in principled compromises that move the country forward, goodwill toward man, and empirical facts. Here's one fact fools ignore. Our Constitution and closely divided polity don't allow for winner-take-all governance. You need the opposition's cooperation to get most big things done. And so I've worked with Democratic colleagues to do things I thought were important. Proudly. When I travel overseas, I like to travel in a bipartisan delegation. I've cultivated many relationships over the years with foreign politicians, journalists, and military leaders that made me a better proponent of my country's interests and values, and more knowledgeable about our allies and adversaries. I want more members of Congress from both parties to acquire that experience with the hope they will help thwart the spread of a form of nationalism that barely distinguishes enemy from friend, seeing every relationship as purely transactional, with a winner and a loser. Congress can produce statesmen as well as the executive branch can, statesmen who will help retain our primacy in world affairs. I'm pleased to help that happen by introducing colleagues to foreign leaders, as John Tower and Scoop Jackson and others did for me. I didn't accept Ted's invitation to become a Democrat, but we did start working together on some issues. Our first project was a patient's bill of rights, legislation that required HMOs to grant patients and doctors more decision-making authority. Specifically, the bill provided that doctors, not insurance company representatives, make medical decisions for their patients. It also guaranteed that patients could see medical specialists and, in a medical emergency, go to the nearest emergency room. In exchange for these protections, I had hoped to include in the bill medical malpractice litigation reform. But one of our other co-sponsors, John Edwards, a trial lawyer who had, as the saying goes, done well by doing good, raised the alarm with a powerful Democratic Party benefactor, the trial lawyers' lobby, a main source of soft or unregulated money for Democrats. They got Democratic leaders to kill the idea. The HMOs were opposed to the bill, as was most of the medical insurance industry and most Republicans. Nevertheless, with unanimous Democratic support and 8 Republican votes, the bill passed the Senate comfortably, though not by a veto-proof margin. The times being what they were, with HMOs suffering adverse publicity from news stories in every state about patients being denied treatment prescribed by their doctors, Republicans knew they had to appear responsive to public concerns. The bill that House Republicans had passed included some of the assurances ours had, but unlike our bill, it did not include provisions to enforce them. The bills couldn't be reconciled in conference. We wanted a bill with teeth. House Republicans did not. A patient's bill of rights wasn't my highest priority that year, but it was high on our agenda, and its failure was a disappointment. I'm sure it was for Ted, too, but one of the qualities I admired most about Ted was he didn't despair in defeat or get carried away in victory. He pressed on. Universal health care, as everyone knows, was his highest priority that year, and every year he served in the Senate. And every year he was disappointed, until Barack Obama was inaugurated President of the United States, and Senate Democrats began working on the Affordable Care Act, which would pass the Senate over united Republican opposition 4 months after Ted died. 3 months later, Obamacare was the law of the land. I had strenuously opposed it, but I was very sorry that Ted had not lived to see his long crusade come to a successful end. He believed it was going to happen. He always had, and knowing him, he wouldn't have spent more than a day celebrating the achievement. He would have had other things to do, other crusades to wage. I would have opposed most of them, but cherished the few times here and there when I could work with him instead of against him. He took the long view, Ted, and he hung in there. I had learned to do that as well, most notably during Russ Feingold's and my multi-year commitment to passing campaign finance reform. Ted knew when an issue was ready for a big push. I did, too. Campaign reform was the central issue of my 2000 campaign. I could see people react favorably to my thesis that campaign reform was a necessary prerequisite to other government reforms, that too much money from too few sources bred a dependency on narrow interests that frequently undermined the national interest. I saw it with my own eyes and the size of my crowds and their enthusiasm. I knew it was time. We also had gotten an assist from the Enron scandal that blew up in the fall of 2001. I had come back to Washington determined to use the political capital I had accumulated to pass a reform bill in that Congress, the 107th, and we did, sending the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act to President Bush in March 2002. Ted had used his influence in his caucus to help overcome concerns about McCain-Feingold raised by important Democratic constituencies, including labor unions. The Democratic Party was more dependent on soft money than were Republicans. The Republican opposition was more upfront and vocal, led by my formidable friend, occasional opponent, and now majority leader, Mitch McConnell. Democratic opponents of the bill were more discreet, but they were very influential and had the ear of senior Democratic leaders. In an exchange on the Senate floor overheard by one of my staffers, John Edwards, who had just finished speaking in support of the bill, asked Democratic leader Tom Daschle if anything could be done to stop it from passing. I'm sure most Senate Democrats genuinely supported reform, including senior senators such as Ted, whose public support meant that even Democrats who were cynical about the issue had to publicly endorse and vote for it, which was good enough for me. All but two Democrats voted for final passage, and 10 Republicans joined me. The harder task was in the House, which Republicans controlled. Although a substantial number of House Republicans supported the bill, enough to constitute with Democratic supporters a large majority in favor, Speaker Denny Hastert had declined to bring the bill up for a vote. House rules being what they are, leadership decisions aren't easily overridden as long as they represent a majority of the majority. To get McCain-Feingold on the calendar over the Speaker's refusal would require a discharge petition which needed only a simple majority to pass. But a majority required 15 or more Republican votes. For House Republicans or Democrats to oppose their leadership and the majority of their caucus to get a bill up for debate and vote is a brave thing to do. Leadership frowns on that kind of independence and punishes it. Suddenly you find yourself sitting on the Postal Service Subcommittee and not in that seat you always coveted on Ways and Means. But the lead Republican sponsor of the bill, Chris Shays of Connecticut, did it. He got 19 Republicans to vote for a discharge petition. His Democratic co-sponsor, Marty Meehan of Massachusetts, provided the necessary votes from his caucus with a major assist from the Democratic leader, Dick Gephardt, who was all in on campaign finance reform despite being a proficient soft money fundraiser. Dick was an impressive behind-the-scenes force. For only the second time in House history, a discharge petition to force action on legislation passed. After that, the vote on the bill itself was anticlimactic. It passed easily, with 41 Republicans voting, with 198 Democrats in favor of it. The president signed it, unenthusiastically, a week later. That's the formula for success for any major piece of legislation. Don't give up. Be persistent. If you can't get it done in this Congress, try again in the next. Give the impression that you're going to make yourself as big a pain in the ass on the issue as you can until some accommodation to your view is made by negotiated compromise, if possible, or by a vote. Be alert to changes in the political environment. Strike hardest when external events give you an advantage. Make necessary compromises to build a bipartisan coalition in favor of it. Use your friendships to recruit as many influential members to your side as you can. Friends on both sides of the aisle will warn you about problems you might not be aware of. They'll tell you who you can count on and who's quietly working against you. Box in the cynics with public and media attention. Make sure the more transactional politicians know there's a cost to opposing the bill. Leave critical responsibilities to your hardest-nosed allies and hope they'll stand up to threats and reprisals. Be the most hard-nosed advocate yourself to set an example. Gather all the pressure you can to move the process along as quickly as possible, even if it ruffles important feathers. A lot of momentum for an issue is illusory and based on excessive faith in the media's sustained attention to it and the potency of its public support. Get it done before your opponents figure out that's not the case. And get a little lucky. That's how the sausage gets made. That's the formula we tried to follow, Ted and I and our fellow travelers, in our multiple attempts to pass comprehensive immigration reform. We failed twice, and then once more after Ted had passed away, despite big majorities in both houses of Congress in favor of it. I'd like to say I'll try again, but that is not up to me anymore. That's a harder disappointment than other defeats have been because, first, It's something that most Americans want, and most members of Congress know is the right thing to do. But most of all, because it's something this country needs to do now, in this political moment, as old fears and animosities that have blighted our history appear to be on the rise again, exploited by opportunists who won't trouble their careers or their consciences with scruples about honesty or compassion for their fellow man. Then there are the true believers in an exclusive America. It might be the cynics who are mainly responsible for inaction on immigration reform. They're Republicans, mostly, in gerrymandered districts where the only challenge they're likely to face is from the far right. But people in both parties, people who know better, have used the lack of progress on immigration reform to their advantage. Their obstruction isn't durable. They'll change when the politics for them change. If and when being pro-immigration becomes a political advantage, they'll shelter immigrants in their own homes. Although their numbers aren't large, it's the true believers who fear America is contaminated by the customs of non-European immigrants who make this moment so fraught. They believe the president shares their prejudice and has promised to enact it into law. They're not only opposed to illegal immigration, they're opposed to immigration, at least immigration from south of the border, and the Caribbean, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They're still a small faction in the Republican Party, but they're the ones getting all the attention right now. They need to be confronted, not ignored or winked at or quietly dismissed as kooks. They need to be confronted before their noxious views spread further and damage for generations the reputation of the Republican Party. A backbench House Republican from Iowa, Steve King, has made a name for himself by regularly espousing ethnocentrism as the principal attribute of American exceptionalism and the foundation of Western civilization. Some days, King plays the social scientist with his openly expressed misapprehension that diversity and assimilation are incompatible. Other times, he seems to go out of his way to offend as many people as he can with his crude insults of folks who came to this country for freedom and opportunity. In a tweet praising Dutch nationalist Geert Wilders, King wrote, "Culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." Leave aside the fact that our civilization isn't in need of restoration, and marvel at the breadth of King's ignorance of history. We built the civilization he wants to restore, the world's freest, most enlightened, and most prosperous civilization, with the help of babies whose parents came here from every corner of the world. We've had periods of practically open immigration and periods where government severely restricted immigration. Through all our history, immigrants kept coming. They came with permission and without it. They came from south of the border, north of the border, across the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. They came to escape violence, poverty, religious intolerance, and powerlessness. Most grasped the bottom rung of the ladder of opportunity in society, working jobs many American citizens wouldn't, living in ethnic ghettos, speaking their native language. They were objects of fear, resentment, disgust, and hate. They were accused of stealing jobs from the native-born. They were victims of prejudice and violence. They dressed oddly. They had strange habits in food and entertainment. Their music was different, their theater too. They had different ideas about farming and business, and yet they assimilated. As they did, they changed our civilization with their additions to it, and they were changed by it. The amalgamation was a more varied, cosmopolitan, rich, accomplished, capable, visionary society held together by shared ideals. That's how assimilation works in this country, and what a country it has become as a result. Because all that's needed to assimilate in America is to embrace our founding convictions, the foundation of Western civilization, that all have an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to the protections of law, to be governed by consent, to speak freely, practice their religion openly, go as far as their industry and talent can take them. That's it, and it's beautiful in its wise simplicity. People came to this country and brought their culture and languages and customs with them, infused them in the stew of American culture, and became Americans. You can speak Spanish or Mongolian. You can like Yiddish theater. You can hum music from the steppes of Central Asia. You can worship Jesus or Allah or your ancestors. You can celebrate Cinco de Mayo or St. Patrick's Day. You can be sentimental and proud of the heritage you brought with you. You can change American arts, food, and industry. Only our ideals must remain unaltered. You have to give your allegiance to those, and most immigrants do. They came here for the protection and opportunities our ideals provide. And often they do a good deal more than adhere to the country's values. They fight and die for them, too. The first American combat casualty of 2018 was an immigrant, Sergeant First Class Mikhail Golan from Fort Lee, New Jersey, a 34-year-old Green Beret who immigrated from Latvia when he was 21. He was the latest of many thousands of immigrants, authorized and unauthorized, who gave their lives for America. As long as you respect the rights and property of your fellow Americans, you are entitled to their respect, whether they give it to you or not. You have the same rights. You are protected by the same laws. You're welcome to your opportunities. You're welcome to America, land of the immigrant's dream. Steve King and his immigrant-bashing cohort, and let's be as clear about it as Mr. King has been, he's not just opposed to illegal immigration, but also to the current rules and levels of legal immigration. Understand, none of this for the very simple reason that they don't understand American exceptionalism. They believe exceptionalism is the quality of a culture dominated by the customs, beliefs, and experiences of a single race and religion, not just allegiance to ideals that, while they are part of that culture, are universal, endowed to humanity by our Creator. Here is one of the best illustrations of American exceptionalism I've ever heard, offered by an American president who believed this country was the most special place on earth, Ronald Wilson Reagan. America represents something universal in the human spirit. I received a letter not long ago from a man who said, "You can go to Japan to live, but you cannot become Japanese. You can go to France to live and not become a Frenchman. You can go to live in Germany or Turkey, and you won't become a German or a Turk." But then he added, "Anybody from any corner of the world can come to America to live and become an American." What he meant was that in all those other countries, you must be born there to be of there. Even if you're a legal resident of long standing, a citizen, even if you make a good living there, are protected by the same laws that protect the native-born, speak the language fluently, cheer for local sports teams, listen to the same music, cook the same food, fly the same flag, vote for the same candidates. Even if you run for public office there, you still can't assume the national identity if you were born elsewhere. You have to have been born a member of the tribe. Anyone can become an American if they embrace our values. Anyone. You don't even have to speak the language. As a practical matter, you'll have an easier time of it here if you learn English. But even a common language isn't essential to assimilation, not in this country. Spanish has been spoken in Arizona centuries longer than English has. Plenty of Italian, Polish, Serbian, Russian, German, and every other kind of non-English-speaking immigrants came to this country and struggled to learn the language. They relied mostly or exclusively on their native tongue to talk with family and friends, and yet managed to communicate with English-speaking Americans while their children grew up bilingual. There are valid arguments for and against high levels of immigration. You can argue that immigrants are depressing wages and taking jobs from native-born Americans, or taking more jobs than they're creating. You can argue they're a drain on public resources, straining school systems and human services, while not contributing enough to public treasuries or local economic growth to compensate. I think those arguments are mistaken, and the facts support my view. But they're not outlandish. Nor are they racist or expressions of the narrow-minded nationalism of Steve King and Steve Bannon and those parts of the America First crowd that misunderstand American culture and exceptionalism. Demographics aren't destiny. Our culture isn't the work of one race or religion. To suggest otherwise is to contradict our ideals and to doubt their power. What is behind that point of view? Often it's little more than a reaction to different behavior and tastes that are perceived as an attack on the culture, on the American way, especially in previously homogeneous small towns and rural communities. Hearing a foreign language spoken where only English was ever heard, seeing new restaurants and shops cater mostly to immigrants. Finding your kid's school pageant includes music from another country performed in another language. Driving by a familiar neighborhood and being taken aback by the colors the houses are painted or the way the yards are kept. In some communities, these sudden departures from the familiar can make folks worry America is being appropriated by a foreign culture. It's not. America is absorbing, as it always does, the latest contributions to our tastes and look and sound. It's new. It's foreign. But it isn't an assault on our culture. In Arizona, no one, Anglo or Hispanic, native-born or immigrant, would think twice about hearing Spanish spoken anywhere or the prevalence of Mexican restaurants or the prominence of Hispanic heritage in the local humanities. To be sure, there is anger over illegal immigration in Arizona, too, at times more than there is in parts of the country that have only recent experience with a wave of immigrants locating there. Arizona is a border state and bears the brunt of the economic, environmental, and criminal impact illegal immigration has on communities. Ranches and towns along the border can be dangerous places for the unauthorized immigrant and the native-born. But for centuries, Hispanic influence has played a prominent part in shaping the culture of the American Southwest. We identify with them. That's not to say there aren't Arizonans who view immigration as a threat to civilization or share resentments and fears harbored by people in other states. There are. And there are also people here, as there are in every other place in this country, whose views about immigrants, at least non-European immigrants, are just racist. They can be cruel. But their influence in the immigration debate is marginal, limited usually to making themselves and sometimes non-racist immigration restrictionists look bad. Unlawful immigration is a serious legal, economic, commercial, and security problem. It is not our biggest or most dangerous problem, not by any stretch of the imagination. But it is a serious problem, especially for border states. A comprehensive policy to address the problem should have been signed into law more than a decade ago. It's not that complicated. Its provisions are obvious, practical, and humane. That a compromise immigration reform policy is no closer to being enacted today than it was when we first attempted it is mostly attributable to the misinformation and downright lies that inflame opponents, which have only gotten more pervasive and inflammatory over the last decade. Here's a little straight talk. First, there are 11 to 12 million immigrants, give or take, residing in this country without permission. Most of them are never going to leave, and there really isn't much we can do about it, or that we should want to do about it. About 7 million are from Mexico and Central America. The other 4 to 5 million came from all over, from China to Ireland. 2/3 of adult unauthorized immigrants have been here for at least a decade. They're integrated into the fabric of our communities. In a word, but for their illegal status, they are assimilated, and most of them aren't going anywhere. The physical and legal infrastructure and the nationwide hard-heartedness required to round up and deport 11 to 12 million mostly decent, hard-working, well-liked people will never exist. To attempt anything like it would produce an economic, social, and humanitarian catastrophe. It would hurt communities all over the country, shrink revenue bases, necessitate tax increases and cuts in services. Businesses large and small would be damaged or destroyed by sudden losses of employees and customers. Friendships would be lost. Students hauled from schools, valued members of community organizations treated like criminals, families separated as teenage children born here to immigrant parents are U.S. citizens, and many will stay to make their way on their own in their native land. It would destroy the spirit of communities and our reputation as a compassionate and practical people. Second, the great majority of unauthorized immigrants came here to find work and raise their families, like most immigrants have throughout our history. They are not the rapists, killers, and drug dealers of fevered imaginations on the right. They're not the cause of the opioid epidemic. They're decent people working hard to make better lives. Only a small fraction ever commit violent crimes, a much lower percentage than native-born violent criminals. Only 3% have committed a felony of any kind. About a third own their own homes. A third have children born here. They pay taxes, obey the laws, contribute positively to our economy and society, serve in our armed forces, are killed and wounded in overseas conflicts, and live in fear they'll be discovered and expelled from the land of their dreams. Third, since 2007, most immigrants who come here without permission simply outstay their visas. They don't cross the border illegally. And since the Great Recession, net illegal immigration has been flat or negative as more immigrants voluntarily returned to their native countries as jobs were scarce. A wall along the southern border isn't going to solve the problem. It might make it worse. Spending tens of billions of dollars on a dubious barrier to illegal immigration takes resources away from more effective border security and enforcement. There are long stretches of the southern border where the topography makes a wall impractical. Where a physical barrier is feasible, fences are better than walls for an obvious reason. They're transparent. You can see what people on the other side are doing. Where barriers aren't feasible, drones, sensors, and cameras can provide better security. No matter what you build, a wall or a fence, no matter how high and forbidding it is, it can be scaled, or tunneled under, or breached in some way. Build a 30-foot wall, and someone will get rich selling 30-foot ladders. And walls and fences cannot apprehend anyone. You need people to do that. And there will never be enough Border Patrol agents to monitor 24 hours a day every stretch of a 2,000-mile border, especially if you're spending $20 billion on a wall. We can make it harder to cross the border illegally. We can reduce the numbers of people walking over, wading across, digging under, climbing over the border. We can build a series of hugely expensive walls and fences that look impregnable. We can hire thousands of new Border Patrol agents. We can crack down on employers of unauthorized immigrants. We can do most of the things the opponents of comprehensive immigration reform demand, and they might significantly reduce the number of unauthorized immigrants entering the country. But people are still going to cross that border illegally every day. We can restrain illegal immigration. We cannot stop it altogether. There is one way to curtail illegal immigration that's more effective than all the others. An economic downturn and lack of job opportunities here will do it, as we saw during the last recession. Again, that's because virtually all adults entering our country illegally aren't doing it to commit crimes or live on welfare. They're seeking work they don't have in their home countries. Fourth, unauthorized immigrants aren't depriving millions of native-born Americans of employment. Most jobs taken by immigrants are low-paying and have the hardest conditions. Their employers have trouble filling payrolls. Many jobs are seasonal or otherwise irregular employment. Unauthorized immigrants are not sucking up all the blue-collar jobs in the country, as their most hyperbolic antagonists insist. They make up approximately 5% of the workforce. Even in communities where immigrants have taken jobs that might otherwise have been taken by native residents, Their economic activity, their spending on local goods and services, creates new job opportunities for locals. There are politicians today who would have Americans believe that illegal immigration is one of the worst scourges afflicting the country. Some who espouse that nonsense believe it to be true. Their opinions were formed in restricted information loops as they communicate mostly or exclusively with people who believe the same. Many more know it isn't so and are cynically claiming otherwise for one of a couple reasons. I expect most are identifying a scapegoat people can blame for their dissatisfaction because it suggests there is an easy fix for difficult problems, an easy fix that's easy to campaign on. Others are doing it for more sinister reasons they're reluctant to acknowledge publicly, including racial prejudice. Whatever their reasons, the cynical and the ignorant promotion of false information and unnecessary fear have the same outcome. Decent, hard-working people who mean no harm are blamed for crime, unemployment, failing schools, and various other ills, and become in the eyes of many the objects of hate and fear. The other consequence is that Americans who are having a hard time of it, people with fewer job opportunities than previous generations had, people with children in underperforming schools, families who have been victimized by crime or lost a loved one to drugs, are deluded into believing there's a simple remedy for all of it. Round up all the illegals and deport them. The cynic knows that isn't going to happen, and even were such a roundup possible, it wouldn't appreciably improve any of the problems they blamed on immigrants. Of course, they wouldn't ever admit their prescription was bullshit. They would just perpetuate the delusion, keep blaming the swamp for not doing enough to rid the country of the scourge. Some politicians will always see an advantage in it, and some folks will always fall for it. But America's demographics are changing inexorably, and with it public opinion as well. Soon, scapegoating immigrants is going to help the Republican Party lose more elections than it helps win. Nearly 57 million people living in the United States are Hispanic, about 18% of the population, a percentage that has been steadily growing for years. In 1 year, of the 2.5 million people who were added to the population, almost half were Hispanic. In 40 years, the number of Hispanic Americans is projected to reach 119 million, nearly 30% of the population. As a matter of survival, the Republican Party has to be competitive with the fastest-growing segment of the population. States such as Arizona and Texas, vote-rich, reliable red states, will become competitive for Democrats. Arizona will get there first. Trump only won it by 4%, less than half the margin Governor Romney won with in 2012. And when Texas goes, there is no conceivable way Republicans can win a presidential election given the Democrats' lock on New York and California, also related partly to Hispanic alienation from Republicans. Let's use my state as an example. The Hispanic segment of Arizona's population is approaching one-third. More Hispanics are enrolled in Arizona schools than any other ethnic group. 44% of students are Hispanic. 291,000 Arizona Hispanics voted in the 2008 presidential election. 8 years later, the number had almost doubled to 550,000. As a border state, Arizona confronts some of the worst problems associated with streams of unauthorized immigrants regularly entering the state. And that made for some distress and hard feelings, which resulted in legislation and referenda that seemed harsh and discriminatory, which in turn led to hard feelings and distrust among Arizona Hispanics. Exit polling in 2016 suggested that President Trump won more than 30% of Hispanics in Arizona. Analysis based on comprehensive and precise polling indicates his share of their vote could have been as low as 12%, which would partly explain why he won the state so narrowly. That isn't terribly surprising, given his insulting references to unauthorized immigrants and the hard positions the state adopted in recent years to punish and apprehend them, exacerbated by the offensive statements and policies of Maricopa County's notorious former sheriff, convicted felon Joe Arpaio. Yet for all that trouble, Arizona life is a blend of Hispanic and Anglo influences. We know each other, we're used to each other, having not merely coexisted for centuries, but having built together from a desert wilderness this thriving state. In other places in the country, disruptions caused by the sudden arrival of an immigrant community can include the shock of the new and different. Obviously, that's not the case here. And things have settled down in Arizona in recent years. Most Arizonans have a pretty practical take on the problem of illegal immigration. We know illegal immigration will never be stopped entirely. We know most people are coming because there's work here, because they're needed. We want the border made more secure. We want the rule of law respected. We want to save people from dying in the desert where they were left by unscrupulous coyotes. We want to prevent the environmental and private property damage caused by illegal crossings. We want to interdict drugs flowing across the border and into the veins of kids. We want responsible officials to tackle these problems with sensible policies. And we want people treated with respect for their dignity. Our own experiences inform our views of immigrants. A recent Arizona poll found that more than two-thirds of Arizonans don't want all unauthorized immigrants deported. Two-thirds don't think a border wall makes sense. Two-thirds don't believe immigrants increase crime rates. Three-quarters allowed that immigrants don't take jobs from citizens. Over 80% believe they're good for the economy and improve American society. It's not that Arizonans don't care about border security. Of course we do. We deal every day with problems caused by unsecured borders. I campaigned on improving security, and every immigration bill I've sponsored has proposed measures to strengthen the border and provided the resources to do it. In a campaign ad, I called, notoriously my critics would say, for finishing the dang fence. I probably wouldn't have emphasized the measure if it weren't very popular with my constituents, but I meant it. We need effective barriers on the border. Arizonans know from experience that fences are more practical in many places than a wall would be, but that doesn't mean they don't want improvements made. And familiarity has bred appreciation here for the character and culture of immigrants that I'm sure will be the case in time in other parts of the country when people are no longer perceived as aliens, but as neighbors. Right now, Republicans are on the wrong side of that progress, and if we want to retain our competitiveness in the fastest-growing communities in the country, we'll stop letting the zealots drive the debate and fix the problem that gives them their soapbox. We can begin by permanently legalizing the status of unauthorized immigrants who were brought here as children, the so-called Dreamers. America is the only country they know. It would be a surpassingly cruel act to deport them, and it would earn Republicans the enmity of not only Hispanic Americans, but the enmity of their neighbors and friends as well. Most Arizona high school seniors are Hispanic. Do you think most of them would consider voting for the party that pulled their friends out of school, took them away from their teams and clubs and neighborhoods, and put them on buses to Mexico? We face much more difficult and complicated problems in this century than illegal immigration. If we have the political will, the solution isn't hard to envision, if for no other reason than because variations of the solution have been proposed 3 times in the last 12 years. But having the political will requires doing something Republican leadership isn't comfortable doing, acting over the objections of a minority of Americans, which on this issue is mostly comprised of Republicans. Most of the provisions of an effective comprehensive immigration reform were included in the first immigration bill Ted Kennedy and I worked on in 2005 and 2006. The late Arlen Specter was the primary sponsor of the bill the Senate debated in 2006. He was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time, which had jurisdiction for the issue and sent the bill to the full Senate. But it was an amended version of the bill Ted and I and our staffs had written and introduced in 2005, working with colleagues Chuck Hagel, Mel Martinez, Lindsey Graham, and prominent conservative Sam Brownback. The House had passed a very different immigration bill near the end of 2005,